From WNYC in New York, this is On the Media. Brooke Gladstone is off this week. I'm Bob Garfield.
At least 49 people are dead this morning, dozens others injured.
This time, it was on the other side of the world.
A mass shooting at two mosques in Christchurch, New Zealand.
49 people killed in a shooting massacre at two mosques. The gunman live streaming the horror.
Not Pittsburgh, not Charleston, not Santa Barbara, not Jeffersontown, Kentucky. But it was as familiar as it was distant. White man, anger, racial hatred, guns, death. It was like traveling someplace exotic and finding a McDonald's. Terrorism as American franchise, with all the uniformity that goes with it. Horror, tears, and even before the victims are identified, the search for answers.
Why would you do this? Why he did it, I don't think we'll ever really know. Yeah. I mean, the depths of his mind, it's impossible to understand.
No, not really. We knew immediately, because as the franchise operator's guide dictates, the killer told us.
The suspect posted a racist manifesto online.
Of course a manifesto.
He, in his manifesto, talked about the fact that he saw President Trump as a symbol for renewed white identity.
He's trolling. He thanked PewDiePie and said that Candace Owens was his biggest inspiration. And
many in the media did just what he planned for them to do, spread his half-baked and paranoiac ideology. Not to mention the at least 1.5 million people who uploaded a video of the live-streamed attack to Facebook in the first 24 hours following the event. And it worked for the same reason the Big Mac is reliably delicious wherever in the world you order it. Franchisees know how to make the special sauce. But in an especially meta phenomenon, in the aftermath of Christchurch, the media were aware of what they were doing as they did it, and some, against all impulses of who, what, when, where, why, resisted amplifying the killer's twisted ideology or even mentioning his name. Here's New Zealand Prime Minister Jacinda Ardern.
I implore you, speak the names of those who were lost rather than the name of the man who took them. He may have sought notoriety, but we in New Zealand will give him nothing, not even his name.
In this hour, we will examine the tension between the quest for understanding and the proliferation of evil. And we'll begin with Joan Donovan, director of the Technology and Social Change Research Project at Harvard's Shorenstein Center. Because those franchisee rules are now well understood, she says, the media in the aftermath of Christchurch actually comported themselves better than in the past.
I facetiously have been declaring that we're winning because one of the main things that I've been asking for since 2016 is that journalists stop calling white supremacists for validation and verification about white nationalist and white supremacist ideas. So the fact that we're not seeing new white supremacists platformed in the media is an amazing outcome of journalists learning from the past. Other things that I've been really happy to see, very few journalists are directly linking to the manifesto. Of course, we're still seeing some screenshots, and that's a problem. But overall, journalists are avoiding what we would call lurid curiosity, explaining and annotating this manifesto and linking directly to it. And I think that that's important because when we link to these things outside of our own articles, we invite our audiences to move away from our own explanations and framings and into the anonymous forums which heroize this attacker. It's very important for journalists as well as researchers not to allow attackers as well as white nationalists and white supremacists to drive our attention to their issues and their claims.
God help us all if he posts a manifesto. We can't resist a manifesto.
I think one of the problems that we're also having and we need to address is the degree to which we even give ideas like this, terms we might use for artists or great thinkers, the notion of the manifesto here, this is not really a manifesto. It's really disjointed. It makes reference to a bunch of different incoherent ideas. And in that sense, it's much more like a rant or a screed. The other thing that we have to understand is that the screed functions a lot more like a press kit. We're also not going to get the conversation in the public that we need about Islamophobia if we focus on this person's words and ideas.
All right, so let's say the mainstream press has learned from the past. Does it matter? If the problem is proliferation and memification and glorification, doesn't the larger responsibility fall on the social networks, on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, YouTube? Facebook took down 1.5 million posts of the original massacre live stream, which is an astounding intervention, but ultimately just a drop in the bucket? This is not a rhetorical question, it's a question.
Yeah, so when we talk about amplification, we do have to understand that the distribution of content online, be it journalist articles or user-generated content, is different from the ways in which the press has acted as a gatekeeper in the past. But I will say that the press still holds significant authority within the minds of the public as the first draft of history. And these are the documents that are going to survive this moment in internet history. So, for instance, algorithms are not stable. So in a week from now, we're going to see changes to what shows up on the first page of Google. In a month from now, we're going to see even more radical changes in terms of what happens when you search for Christchurch. So it's important that we do journalism today so that other social scientists and historians have a record of what happened. But amplification is a passing problem. It's a problem of now. And I should say that this was a choice that Facebook made to take this content down. One of the things that we've noted in the content moderation policies of Twitter, for instance, is that they don't take down certain posts that they consider newsworthy, even if they are breaking their terms of service around harassment or hate speech or incitement to violence. And so we have to recognize that the platform companies are making a choice, but they haven't really developed a code of ethics or a set of principles about amplification that I think now that this event has happened that they will have to do in the future.
On this show, we've often reported about the conflict of interest that faces the platforms. They literally profit in dollars and cents from the interests of malicious actors. And just the morbid curiosity and impulses of billions of users. Now, in the aftermath of something like Christchurch, it's of course easy and important to ask tough questions of the press and to demand accountability from the platforms. But in some ways, does not the fault lie within users, within us?
One of the things that the research that I did at Data and Society is really focused on is the way in which the profit incentives on platforms misalign with society or user interest. That is to say that if I post more and more extreme content, if I use my live stream to do something horrific in order to call attention to something, I'm really incentivized by that platform's business model to do so. We cannot know what the intent of many of the 1.5 million uploads on Facebook were, but these aren't just people that support this ideology. Some of these are looking to upload the content for clickbait. We can know that some of them were profit-driven.
I guess what I was getting at is that, like you, I am also extremely suspicious of the 1.5 million uploads of that video, and I suspect the worst. But to tell you the truth, I'm much more concerned with the whatever it is about human nature that makes this ecosystem survive.
In 2015, when I turned to studying hate movements online, I was really horrified to see the amount of places that you could go to if you were interested in white supremacy or white nationalism. And I can't say, though, that that felt all that different from the communities that I was exposed to as a young punk rocker in Boston, where there were a lot of skinheads who were doing active recruitment at different clubs. And I've seen people fall into those traps of trying to make meaning out of their lives by hating others. And unfortunately, you know, the internet can do many things for many people, but we've also reached a scale now where we're not talking about small subcultures online. We're not talking about interest groups online. What really scares me about the ways in which these communities foment their rage online is the degree to which they're becoming internationally networked. But in a strange way, I'm hopeful that the good nature of others will be able to overcome this as we face and expose this undercurrent online.
Joan, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Joan Donovan is the director of the Technology and Social Change Research Project at Harvard's Shorenstein Center. Coming up, getting into the heads of the fanatics. This is On the Media. This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield. When events like Christchurch happen, the elements may indeed be obvious. Guns, hatred, alienation. But the obvious is also reductive and risks obscuring larger forces at play. The same goes with the vocabulary of race violence. White nationalist, white identity, alt-right, white supremacy, white power. They're used interchangeably, which further clouds the picture. Christchurch, says University of Chicago Professor Kathleen Ballou, is the latest manifestation not just of resentment and paranoia or even radical racism, but a clearly defined revolutionary movement. Kathleen, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
Why do you specify white power versus, say, white supremacy?
I think the closest term would be white nationalism. But the thing is that when we talk about nationalism, a lot of people think about sort of an overexertion of patriotism. And the assumption there is that the nation implied in white nationalism is going to be the United States or New Zealand. In fact, the white power movement is interested in a transnational white population that is attempting to seize control of first white homelands and then eventually the world as a white nation. And for this reason, I think white power is a better term for thinking about this in our reporting and in our debating, because it conveys the radical future imagined by this movement. And I think white supremacy is just overly broad. White supremacy is an ideology held in common by many people who have less extremist and less violent political ideologies. And also, white supremacy, of course, describes many elements of our governance, our distribution of resources, our criminal justice system, our courts, right? So being specific about the radical nature of this movement is important.
It's obvious that white racism goes back centuries in this country and abroad. But you place the white power movement at a particular place in American history, namely the end of the Vietnam War. Why then?
So the Vietnam War created a narrative about betrayal by the state that brought Klansmen, neo-Nazis, followers of Christian identity, skinheads, radical tax protesters, white separatists, and more into this common cause. And this was accomplished both by a sense of profound distrust in the federal government and other sort of institutions, and also mobilized by fears of racial annihilation, fears of the end of the white race and being overrun. The Vietnam War is also important here because it dramatically escalated the impact of this movement on civilians, because the white power movement was able to mobilize the weapons and tactics of that war in a kind of paramilitary activism that came home to the United States. I should clarify a little bit what I'm saying, because the number of returning Vietnam veterans who joined this movement is very, very small, statistically insignificant even. But the veterans who did join white power groups had enormous impact on their social and cultural formation and also on the strategies and weapons that they use.
Now, this period that you describe, post-Vietnam War, occurred just before the Reagan administration, which was very conservative and kind of big government hating, and you would have thought would have been a very satisfying political outcome for the people we're talking about, but no, au contraire.
So this movement turned revolutionary in 1983. It declared war on the federal government and began a string of infrastructure attacks, assassinations, and other actions that were intended to foment race war. The fact that that happened, as you say, during the second term of the Reagan administration and not under a leftist executive indicates that having what people in the center might perceive to be a friendly administration is not going to be enough for activists in this kind of an ideology. They look at someone like Reagan and see him as moderate. They see frustration with the distance between campaign promises and what people can actually put through. And they sort of see this as a referendum that electoral politics are never going to achieve the kind of radical social change they want.
I'm going to talk about ideology for a moment. A recurring theme, it seems to me, is this notion of white genocide. And with that paranoid worldview, a certain word keeps popping up.
You will not replace us.
What does that even mean?
People in the white power movement see a whole number of social issues as fundamentally being about a threat to white reproduction. Abortion is a threat because it might kill white children. Immigration is a threat because of the threat of hyper-fertile populations of color overrunning a white nation. LGBT rights and feminism are a threat because they might encourage white women not to bear white children. All of this is felt not as a soft demographic change, but as a real apocalyptic threat.
But let me just observe that it's not just mass murderers in New Zealand or Nazis in Charlottesville. Republican Congressman Steve King said on Twitter, quote, "We can't restore our civilization with someone else's babies." And here's right-winger Laura Ingraham on Fox this week.
Democrats were once the party of ideas, the party of the little guy. Well, the little guy is actually doing much better under Trump, and they know it. So what's their answer? To replace you.
Is there more danger from terrorists or from this ideology seeping into the political mainstream?
Here's one way to think about it. The white power movement is a tiny group of people. In the period of my study, we're only talking about 10 to 75,000 people who are in kind of the inner hardcore ring that might carry out an act of violence or support one. Outside of that, there's another, 150,000 people who do things that are public-facing that are more like attend rallies, buy newspapers, and agree with the ideology. And outside of that, there's another 450,000 people. Now, those people don't buy a newspaper, but they regularly read the newspapers, right? And there's a diffusion of ideas. So then we could imagine that outside of that, which is now a population that's not usually counted, there are probably a larger group of people who would never read something that says, you know, newspaper of the Knights of the KKK, but who would agree with the ideas that are presented in one. And you can imagine that this model of organizing works both to push ideas from that hardcore inner circle out into the mainstream and to pull people in towards the middle who can be radicalized towards racist violence. So I think we have to think really carefully about how fringe ideas move and also about the capacity of these groups to continue recruiting people to do harm.
On the subject of relative danger, I want to come to the question of leadership. The Oklahoma City bombers didn't have a boss. Dylann Roof didn't have a boss. The Christchurch shooter didn't have a boss. And yet they're responding to something central. What and how?
They're responding to a coherent political ideology that lays out a plan of attack. One of the places that we can see this is in the dystopian novel that becomes not only a manual for the movement, but kind of an ideological lodestar. It's called The Turner Diaries, and it's published in the late 1970s and then popularized over the 1980s and forward. The Turner Diaries lays out this incredibly huge end goal, which is not only the successful takeover of the United States, but the annihilation of all people of color all over the world through nuclear and biological weapons. Group leaders are able to sort of spread this idea, get people organized into cells, distribute money to those cells, and then connect them through computer message boards and then through the internet such that all of these things can kind of evolve independently, but towards a common purpose. What it shows us is that these acts of violence are never supposed to be the end point in and of themselves, but are supposed to awaken this broader white public into race war.
The Turner Diaries has become, as you say, a lodestar, an aspiration for a gathering race war. Is it happening?
In order to really reckon with this kind of violence, we would need to connect these disparate acts by the ideology of the perpetrators. So rather than reporting on, say, the attack on the Tree of Life synagogue as an anti-Semitic crime, the attack on Charleston worshipers as a racist crime, and the Christchurch shooting as an Islamophobic crime, we really have to look at the fact that all of those perpetrators are motivated and connected by the same ideology, the same kind of view of what their violence is supposed to do. We could add many more episodes to that list and do the work of connecting these dots together. Certainly things like the Oklahoma City bombing and Anders Breivik's attack in Norway would belong in that same story. Doing that would create a different kind of reporting that doesn't rely on the idea of lone wolves, but actually does the work of connecting these events together. It would allow a different kind of public conversation about what these events mean. And it would create a different kind of expectation about what kind of surveillance and legal resources need to be dedicated to this moving forward.
Elsewhere in this program, we're considering the other edge of this double-edged sword, however, and that is with the increasing attention, we are buoying the very movement that we're trying to isolate and understand. How do you square that circle?
I profoundly disagree with the idea that we should not talk about this violence. We should call this a manifesto because it is a political ideology and we should understand it as such. I believe we should name the gunman because this is part of a historical project of connecting these acts of violence together. And I also think, not for nothing, this movement wants us not to understand it as a movement. This movement has worked incredibly hard for several decades to appear precisely as the acts of disconnected madmen rather than as a groundswell. The term lone wolf was coined by people in this movement in order to muddy the waters about prosecution and public understanding. When we report this as the work of single actors, even of cells, what we're missing is a huge component of the organizing, which involves deep social ties. This is a movement that rests just as heavily on things like shared childcare and homeschool curricula as it does on leaderless resistance and lone wolf violence, quote unquote. We have to understand all of it in order to organize any kind of social response. And I'll say this too, there have been copycat attacks after all of these acts of violence. There are people who will want to emulate the Christchurch shooting just as they attempted to do that after the actions of the Order in the 1980s or the Oklahoma City bombing. We cannot unring the bell of that viral video. This person is already enshrined in various corners of the internet. But social response, really understanding what this is and devoting appropriate resources and time to combating this violence, we have to understand it.
Kathleen, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Kathleen Ballou is a professor of history at the University of Chicago and author of Bring the War Home, The White Power Movement and Paramilitary America. Ballou reminds us that far-right groups, in their public communications, paint the picture they want us to see. But what happens behind the scenes as the foot soldiers of these groups debate and plan their next moves? One place you may find them is a chat room platform called Discord, popular among gamers and other internet-savvy communities. It's also become a home for those looking to meet like-minded white nationalists. A large trove of this back and forth was uncovered by the left-wing media collective Unicorn Riot, which then revealed the conversations of such neo-Nazi groups as Patriot Front and the now-defunct Traditionalist Workers' Party. Unicorn Riot scored its first load of Discord chats in August 2017, the weekend of the Unite the Right rally in Charlottesville. It reported stories, shared the leaked chats, and built a database of hundreds of thousands of messages completely open to the public. Quick warning here, some very graphic misogynist language is coming up. Dan Feit is co-founder of Unicorn Riot. Dan, welcome to OTM.
Glad to be here.
The messages back and forth were ostensibly private. how did they find their way into your hands?
So Discord works through authentication. And so if someone who wants to investigate, you know, far right, Nazis, fascists, white supremacists, if they work at it, they can create a false identity that appears to be another fascist. They can then become vetted. Then they can be allowed into inner rooms, more quote unquote elite chat rooms and so forth. And essentially, the account has access to all the pertinent chat rooms in the server. And then you can basically use particular software to pull out every individual chat. And then you can archive all the chats and develop a search engine to make the chats readable.
One of your pieces had some audio from chatter among those in the Patriot Front.
I have a 40 cal Glock, a 9mm Glock, and then three AR-15s. And all of these are 80%.
Women are retarded. Like, I was in the same logic as you. And then I realized that one, I was like, they can't like do this. Yeah, like a small percentage of them maybe are rational, but like.
Well, exactly. That's why you beat them.
Patriot Front in particular, those audio clips really highlight that misogyny is a critical element of fascist and authoritarian thinking, which is something that not everybody has picked up on. Also, clearly, Patriot Front talks a lot about accumulating weapons and preparing. What's really threatening, too, is there's also people that are on their periphery who might be collecting weapons, who might suddenly snap one day or work up towards something.
And that actually gets to a third level of insight that this Discord chatter offers, and that is that in the aggregate, it kind of dispels the myth of the lone wolf perpetrator. If you go back and look at their chat history, you find out that maybe alone physically at the moment of the crime, but not alone in spirit.
It's very clear that in terms of their frame of mind, before they might try to kill lots of people, they do see themselves as acting in relation to something that is upheld and believed in by a larger group of people. So in that sense, they might not have needed that much help logistically, but in terms of psychologically bringing themselves to that point, that is something that a lot of people are involved with. So you can't really think of them as being lone wolves. One example that I would mention is Taylor Wilson.
The St. Charles man, already facing two terrorism charges for stopping an Amtrak train, is now facing federal gun charges.
He tried to hijack an Amtrak train.
The charges include possession of an unregistered barreled rifle and an unregistered machine gun.
And he was someone who was at Charlottesville.
At his St. Charles home, the FBI later discovered alt-right and neo-Nazi literature, as well as more ammunition and gunpowder.
He was a participant in chats with a number of different groups, including the Traditionalist Workers' Party, National Socialist Legion, and he was sentenced to 14 years in prison after he was arrested. And that's an example of someone who acted alone, but still was certainly acting as if he was connected and motivated by a larger network.
You could say that Discord identifies crimes that were copycat crimes, but I don't even think copycat is quite the right word. It's more like homage. They are done specifically in tribute to those who have been violent before them, right?
The way I would describe this is that because a lot of it has to do with memes or images, they'll take anyone that does a violent, racist, or misogynist act that they can relate to, and they'll break apart the imagery around that person and start remixing it and then identifying with that. They'll idolize Charles Manson or Breivik, the man who shot all those people in Norway. In the case of Dylann Roof, there was one group called Bull Patrol, which took the imagery of his bull haircut and remixed that to develop memes and messaging. There were also the Clark brothers who lived around Washington, D.C.
These Washington, D.C. brothers and their possible connection to synagogue shooting suspect Robert Bowers.
They were in touch with the man that massacred the Jewish people in Pittsburgh.
And one of those brothers was arrested on weapons charges days after allegedly posting on social media that the shooting in Squirrel Hill was, quote, a dry run for things to come.
What's been kind of amazing to me is that even regular people have sometimes reached out to us. Like, they've said, they're suspicious that their niece might be dating a dangerous white supremacist, and they asked us to figure out, is this the same guy as I think this guy is, because he might have the same nickname or whatever. And in the case where that inquiry came in, it was true, it was that guy, and was able to take action there.
You would think that whatever Unicorn Riot is doing pales in comparison to what the FBI is collecting, to what the Department of Homeland Security is collecting for the purposes of anticipating the next attack. Is that happening?
Completely by chance, I had an encounter with a U.S. attorney or assistant attorney, I think, and they were telling me that the FBI didn't have information like this and that they had found it very difficult even to get subpoenas to investigate Facebook group chats, even when there was a lot of evidence. It seems pretty clear that police, state intelligence, investigators weren't really on the ball before Charlottesville happened. They were taken by surprise to some extent. So they've been somewhat, I think, pushed into action by making these kind of data sets available. And then that's enabled a wider public community to raise alarm and say, this is very dangerous. People affiliated with racists and misogynists have been committing mass murders in the United States. And so I think that the picture is somewhat changing.
Dan, it is axiomatic that sunlight is a disinfectant. And therefore, the more that we can learn about these groups, especially the most violent ones, the better the society will be. On the other hand, great, we now know about the Bowl Patrol, courtesy of Unicorn Riot, and so do a bunch of prospective Bowl Patrollers. In fact, so do maybe a much larger number, because it's now disseminated via mass media.
The driving force with these groups is really about power and intimidation and appearing to be strong. And so something like Bowl Patrol, if their internal messages get exposed and it shows who's involved, how they put it together, how they're trying to manipulate people into buying into what they're selling, that doesn't just reveal to everyone what their mechanisms are, it also makes them look weaker. And that's a very important thing when it comes to dealing with authoritarian movements, because it shows that they don't know what they're doing in terms of security. It shows that they just sit around fighting with each other a lot. It shows that they don't get along. They don't have a real plan. They can't put together a rally. They can't do all of the basic things that a political organization would want to do to advance its goals. So, yes, it's true that by having an archive of incredibly derogatory, unpleasant, disturbing material, that it's possible someone might connect to that. But this is also the chance to essentially be a kind of information vaccine, if you will. You'd sort of say, this is the toxic material. This is how it works. This is what it's trying to do. It's actually very weak. And then that demystifies the whole process for someone who is just trying to understand, who might be vulnerable to this thinking. It takes the confusion out of it for a person like that. And it says,
what a bunch of losers.
Yeah. And it gives a person that many more reasons to walk away by using their own content and their own chats against them. We haven't seen any evidence come up that says, oh, well, you guys came up in Discord leaks and you looked even better than you did before. There's really been no evidence of that kind of line of thinking happening.
Dan, thank you.
Yeah, thank you. It's been really great to talk to you.
Dan Feit is co-founder of the nonprofit media organization Unicorn Riot. Coming up, in documenting the mechanics of jihadi propaganda, are scholars doing more harm than good? This is On the Media. This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield. As we've heard, the process of understanding, explaining, and contextualizing terror yields some ratio of reward and risk. Namely, when does the documentation of evil perpetuate evil?
For the remainder of this hour, we'll look at that dilemma at its most polarizing, the study of jihadist movements. It's a subject rich with emotion, disagreement, and just plain ignorance.
And we have won against ISIS. We've beaten them, and we've beaten them badly. We've taken back the land.
That's not true. The physical territory of the so-called Islamic Caliphate in Iraq and Syria, at one point the size of the United Kingdom, has been reduced to a square mile in a Syrian village. But ISIS as an organization, as an idea, and as a threat, has not been defeated. And it is not idle.
I mean, it's still getting a 12-page newspaper out every single week.
Charlie Winter with the International Center for the Study of Radicalization examines the online communications of jihadi terror groups.
It's still capable of producing very glossy, shiny videos that still resonate very well among its supporters and still have an ability to grab attention. It's just right now, the propagandist priorities aren't communicating with the West. Right now, they're thinking about retention, not recruitment.
Even as U.S. forces seem poised to overtake the last ISIS bastion in Syria, Winter says, the violent struggle continues elsewhere.
Let me tell you about a video that was published by the Islamic State's West Africa province, so it's based in Nigeria. So they opened with a few pictures of children playing in the streets, people going to mosques of supposedly idolatrous monuments and tombs being destroyed. And then there was a beheading, an amputation. And then cut back to more shots of people worshipping. And all the time, there was a kind of sepia filter across the screen. It was essentially casting these things that had happened just a few years ago as this new golden age of Islam and showing the Islamic State at its best. The point of doing that, to kind of revitalize the idea of the utopian caliphate, is to provide Islamic State supporters with something to continue fighting for.
It's morning again in Nigeria.
That's right.
That video was recently put online by ISIS and just as quickly removed by major social media platforms, which obviously don't want to be seen as having any hand in glorifying terrorism. But Winter found it anyway on Telegram, a Russia-based encrypted messaging app. It can also be found on a U.S. site called Jihadology, a scholarly repository of jihadi videos, edicts, posters, and speeches documenting first the breathtaking expansion and now dramatic setbacks of the self-proclaimed Islamic Caliphate.
Jihadology has become an invaluable resource, I believe, for academics and scholars who are trying to study the jihadi landscape.
Rukmini Kalamaki covers ISIS for the New York Times.
It's a place that warehouses the videos and the statements of these groups that are, of course, being taken down online by YouTube, by Facebook, by Twitter, etc., in the interest of not finding a greater public.
While it may seem inarguable that knowing more is better than knowing less, it's not hard to understand the impulse behind cutting off the supply of propaganda designed to lure disaffected youth into the terror matrix. After all, didn't Omar Mateen, before entering the Pulse nightclub in Orlando to murder 49 people, scroll through Jihadology? Yes, he did. And come on, academic researchers of child pornography don't repost the porn themselves.
I used to work child protection, and when I worked with researchers there, they would never share any of the content they came across, because whatever they were doing, it started from a point of not making things more available.
Ollie Fisher, director of the British data consultancy Human Cognition, has written in opposition of open access to archives of jihadi propaganda, and he is not alone. In November, the UK Parliament's Intelligence and Security Committee published a report titled The 2017 Attacks, What Needs to Change, detailing efforts to limit access to propaganda on social media. In recent weeks, the European Parliament has debated similar initiatives. Among its likely targets is the blogging and website platform WordPress, host of Jihadology. The notion being, once again, that the videos are dandelions, and the websites scatter the seeds of violence to the winds. Charlie Winter, curator of his own private archive, worries about jihadology.
I don't think we should whitewash the fact that it is and has been useful for groups like the Islamic State in the last few years.
And undeniably, ISIS followers do promote jihadology among themselves, not just as a bazaar, but as a safe harbor for their ideology. Here's jihadism investigator Ali Fisher reading from a Telegram chat among radicals.
These links, by the will of God, do not get deleted. All the while, these will help the supporters in their raids on social media platforms. And we advise you, place these links in the comments section on YouTube. It then goes on to recommend the use of a VPN so that the individual person is protecting themselves. And the links that they are talking about there, about 90-something percent of them are to jihadology.
When the bad guys see your work as indispensable, perhaps that should give pause. Especially, says Fisher, when society is demanding that non-academic platforms eradicate this stuff.
We've seen Facebook, YouTube, under pressure to remove the content from the attacks in Christchurch. And I don't think we can be saying it's okay for one group just to post it all widely on the web, and another group, it's Facebook, so you've got to remove it. To me, it doesn't make a balanced argument.
Fisher also can't reconcile the fact that some individuals have been jailed for posting jihadi content, while scholars and, in some cases, governments make the same practice routine. So, yes, it's clear that there is at least some level of double standard. Less clear is whether the content in question is actually what lures recruits into the terrorist fold to begin with.
There's this assumption that ISIS was particularly successful in getting young people, particularly Westerners, to go to Syria because of its savvy media output.
Amarnath Amarasingham is a senior research fellow at the Institute for Strategic Dialogue.
And so there was a kind of causal link drawn in the minds of some policy people in law enforcement that because ISIS was so good at its social media, that it automatically led to this foreign fighter problem that we're seeing.
But that formulation, Amarasingham says, overestimates the impact of the propaganda and ignores the more significant factor, two-way social media messaging. If you were an ISIS wannabe,
you could reach out to them, you could talk to them, you could get logistical advice, you could ask them who to contact when they're in Turkey to cross the border. And so it became a kind of personal interaction, and friendships started forming, and this kind of online community of jihadist supporters started forming out of this access to these fighters.
There are a number of people who speak about this material without actually having any real knowledge of how the radicalization process works.
The Times' Rukmini Kalamaki.
Telegram, in their secret chat rooms on this encrypted app, is where the group congregates, and anybody that is serious about joining this group finds their way there. If you take away the conveyor belt called jihadology, you're not solving the problem. You'd have to basically shut off the internet to be able to completely shut down the way through which young aspiring jihadists make their way to this ideology and then to the violence that it incites.
Now, not all the hand-wringing envisions shutting down jihadology altogether. The British Parliament is considering the less draconian measure of password protection, and there is some history there. Peter van Ostien is a PhD candidate at the Catholic University of Leuven in Belgium and visiting fellow at the European Foundation for Democracy. He runs his own archive of jihadi propaganda, which, like jihadology, was open to all visitors and drew approximately 100,000 of them a month until 2016, when he says he succumbed to pressure from French, Russian, and Indian governments.
Basically, my website is under lock right now.
To get access, you have to create a WordPress account and request entry from van Ostien.
Everybody gets access. Everybody who asks access to my website, I give them access.
Because he is a single academic without the resources to vet his applicants. How's he to know whether he's being solicited by a tenured professor or Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi?
I know that even jihadis got access to my website, still.
So I guess my question is, what has been accomplished here by those who asked you to put this under lock and key?
Nothing. If it were to stop terrorist propaganda and to slow down the spread of terrorist propaganda, it was a very bad idea to close down my website because it basically didn't help. Basically, they can find their content elsewhere. So what has been accomplished? Nothing. Nothing at all.
And what has been lost?
What has been lost? The content of a lot of most interesting tracts, not only by the Islamic State, but also by Al-Qaeda, and some analysis. I had some guest posts on my website of rather prominent foreign fighters and of rather prominent Al-Qaeda figures. I think the information should be there for the general public, not only for academics and researchers, and not led by media interpretations and by people saying, I heard this from a researcher. We need the hard facts. We need the details. And what's more detailed than footage? Nothing.
It's not just a matter of general public and academic understanding. Jihadology has been the source of crucial intelligence. Seamus Hughes, deputy director of the Program on Extremism at the George Washington University, describes his process when, in a court document, he encountered references to an ISIS senior commander, an American named Zulfi Hoxha.
I thought to myself, I've never heard this guy before, and I track this for a living. And so we started going through all of Jihadology's videos until we found people that purported to be Americans and then cross-referenced that with friends and family who knew Zulfi. And we were able to match up both the voice and ultimately the face.
Sure enough, they found Hoxha on Jihadology in propaganda videos spewing jihadi rhetoric.
Indeed, America today is the one carrying the banner of the cross and waging war against the Muslims. It did not delay in supporting its puppets via air, land, and sea.
Hoxha was thus publicly identified as the first American Islamic State member to be featured in a beheading video. Hughes says, by the way, the government, for its own purposes, uses Jihadology too.
You don't necessarily want your CIA agent in a courtroom in New York talking about ISIS. You don't want to expose your assets. And so they're looking for a different avenue in order to get the information into a court of law. And that means they look at Jihadology in order to get the documents.
So that's the impact on the front lines of intelligence. Then there is the matter of just plain history, of context and understanding versus demagogy and myth. Rukmini Kalamaki refers to the work of Miami of Ohio professor Nathan French, whose scholarship includes reassembling Osama bin Laden's recorded justification for 9/11. In the few months after the attacks, under government pressure, that material had been all but eradicated from American TV news.
And these terrorist statements are now pretty hard to access unless you know how to do it as a specialist. And so I've had people actually say to me that they believe that 9/11 was a reaction to the U.S. invasion of Iraq, literally reversing the events and not understanding that the invasion of Iraq came as a result of 9/11.
More information or less information? Which presents the greater risk? And then there's one other thing, not just documenting history, but documenting responsibility. Peter Van Ostian.
We will need all of this if there will be, and by God, I hope there will be one soon, an international tribunal against ISIS fighters. And we will need as much as evidence as possible. And I sincerely hope that everybody starts to realize what they already destroyed by killing off YouTube videos, even of people watching and filming bombings and what have you. Everybody should be aware, fully aware of what they did.
The irony is pretty thick. ISIS has tried systematically to destroy evidence of modernity. And now, with all good intentions, we may ourselves be destroying evidence of the destruction. We repeatedly reached out to Aaron Zellin, who runs Jihadology, but he declined to comment. That's it for this week's show. On the Media is produced by Alana Casanova-Burgess, Michael Loewinger, Leia Fetter, John Hanrahan, and Asla Chaturvedi. We had more help from Zandra Ellen, and our show was edited this week by our executive producer, Katya Rogers. Our technical director is Jennifer Munson. Our engineers this week were Sam Baer and Josh Hahn. On the Media is a production of WNYC Studios. I'm Bob Garfield.
On the Media is supported by the Ford Foundation, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio.